The National Geographic Society is a center for research, exploration, and intellectual inquiry. It's the home of a great magazine and now a television channel, an institution very widely respected, almost universally known. It didn't start out that way. The National Geographic Society was originally a small group modeled on Britain's Royal Geographic Society that organized in Washington, D.C. after the Civil War. It sponsored scientific lectures and a journal that appeared every once in a while. The whole thing sputtered along until a genius took the helm, Alexander Graham Bell. Yes, that Alexander Graham Bell. He took over as president, hired his future son-in-law, Bert Grosvenor. Their family, the magazine, and the National Geographic Society were intimately intertwined for more than a century afterwards. A new book traces the history of all three and tells the stories of the many celebrated figures connected to the organization, among them Robert Peary, Jane Goodall, Jacques Cousteau, and Louis and Mary Leakey. There are less attractive stories, too. Racism, anti-Semitism, and inside politics. Later in the program, comedians complain about conditions in front of the brick wall. But first, the story of National Geographic. If you have questions about its origins and development, or about its explorers and expeditions, give us a call. Do you read the magazine? Why? Our number is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. The email address is TOTN at NPR.org. Joining us here in Studio 3A is Robert Poole, who spent over 20 years working in various positions with the National Geographic. He retired several years ago as executive editor of the magazine. His book is called Explorer's House, National Geographic and the World It Made. And welcome to Talk of the Nation.
Neil, thank you.
And I wanted to begin by, again, reemphasizing the importance of that family to the story of the National Geographic. In a way, it's a story of nepotism over the past 100 years.
Yes, it is. Yeah, the story of the institution is very much a story of the family from start until present. It began in 1888 with a remarkable fellow named Gardner Green Hubbard, who was a lawyer, an entrepreneur, and he was interested in everything. He passed it on to his son-in-law, Alexander Graham Bell, who really took National Geographic into new areas and made it work, made it go. And then it passed from Bell to his son-in-law, following this tradition of nepotism, Bert Grosvenor. Bert Grosvenor passed it to his son, Melville Grosvenor, and eventually to Gilbert Grosvenor, Melville's son, who remains as chairman of the board of National Geographic today.
Yet throughout all of that time, the National Geographic Society has been a membership organization. It's not owned by anybody, really.
It's owned by the members, and that's what makes the family's legacy, dynasty, this dynasty so remarkable, because they didn't have stock. They didn't own the company. It was just by tradition and by staying power that they kept it going from generation to generation. And this membership idea, I think, has been crucial to the success of National Geographic. All of the money that came in from members went back into operation so that they could afford to send people out like Cousteau, like Jane Goodall, to stay in the field for many weeks, even months at a time, and to put a lot of money into high production values, the best printing, the best paper, the best of everything, really.
Best photographers, best photography as well.
Yes, indeed, yes.
One of the things that's interesting, Bert Grosvenor came in under his father-in-law, or the future father-in-law at first, Alexander Graham Bell, with instructions to modernize the magazine, National Geographic, and change it from a journal that appeared, as I said, every once in a while to something that was going to be the economic engine of the Geographic Society.
Yeah, Bell turned everything upside down. Before he came along in 1889 as president, 1898, it was pretty much a small Washington operation. It existed only to hear itself talk, basically. Bell turned that upside down. He made the magazine the main reason for being, and he wanted to make it a broad-based national operation. And he wanted it to have photographs and maps, which were unusual ideas at the time.
And it's interesting reading some of the arguments dating back to that time. Some of them could have been published last year. The magazine is getting too commercial. It's losing its scientific value. It's broadening it out to the masses. You're making it dumbing it down.
Yes, there was that criticism, but Bell stood up to it, and He was in a pretty good position to do so because he didn't need a job. He was one of the richest men in the country at the time, having invented the telephone. So he had this great attitude about National Geographic and about life. He was interested in everything. He was very optimistic. And I think you see these values even today reflected in National Geographic magazine.
Mm-hmm. As we mentioned, there were some undersides to this story. If Alexander Graham Bell was himself dedicated to the spirit of discovery and the universal rights of man, at times he embraced some dubious causes, including the discredited theory of eugenics.
Yes, he did. He was, as we discussed, he was interested in everything, and he was interested in things that have since proved to be a little not so great.
I think wacky is the word you use.
Wacky,
in the book.
Yes, wacky is the word I used. He was interested in phrenology. He had this.
That's the bumps on the head.
Bumps on the head will tell you what the person underneath is all about. He believed in, for many years, and spent a lot of money breeding twin-bearing sheep because he thought that that would be very, very useful for farmers. They would produce more milk. They would produce more sheep. It didn't work out.
He repudiated eugenics and moved on to other things. But his son-in-law had some very dubious policies, certainly in terms of, tell us about the overt racism within the magazine itself and the organization, the National Geographic Society.
Yes, from time to time there was racism and there was anti-Semitism within the organization. It didn't show up too often in the magazine, but when it did, it was quite memorable. The most overt instance of it was in 1937. There was an article in National Geographic on Berlin, which was quite glowing about the Nazis, and you'd have to describe it as a pro-Nazi article.
Mm-hmm.
The person who wrote that article was an American citizen named Douglas Chandler. He stayed in Germany during the war and broadcast for Nazi radio. He was later convicted of treason. So, yes, National Geographic had this streak of anti-Semitism and some anti-Semitic beliefs. They also, for a long while, for much of the 20th century, did not really want persons of color as members of the National Geographic Society. They were afraid that blacks would appear for lectures at National Geographic in Washington, D.C., which was at that time functionally segregated for much of the 20th century until the 40s and 50s. It's not excusing it, but the Geographic reflected that attitude, and the people running it tried to weed out black members. All of this changed, of course, in the 50s and 60s.
We're speaking with Robert Poole, the author of Explorer's House, National Geographic and the World It Made, if you'd like to join us. Our number is 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. Our email address is totn@npr.org. And let's begin with Don, who's calling from Boulder, Colorado.
Hi, Neil.
Hi.
I grew up in the 30s when I found the National Geographic's attitude toward race to be much different. In fact, it was my first glimpse of bare-breasted maidens from my grandfather's farm in Torrington, Connecticut, and I've continued to subscribe ever since, for more mature reasons, of course.
I assume your grandfather kept old copies of the magazine rather than bare-breasted maidens at his farm in Connecticut.
Indeed he did.
Indeed he did. This is Don is hardly the only person to have this story of this is an adolescent boy's dream, the National Geographic.
Yes, I think a lot of young men and young women gained their knowledge of anatomy from those old National Geographics. For the record, the first bare-breasted woman appeared in National Geographic, I believe, in 1896. So this is something they did for a long time.
They were all from Bali, is that right?
No, not. There were some from Bali, but there were a lot from Africa, too.
Mm-hmm.
And I wonder, has the magazine ever gotten into trouble for this policy, and has the policy changed over the years?
There were complaints about it at the time, just as there were complaints about other things that Burt Grosvenor and Alexander Graham Bell did, but Burt Grosvenor said very with a straight face that this is ethnography, and we are merely presenting people as they appear in their own countries, and that's the way they will appear in National Geographic.
I guess we should point out. I'm sorry, Don, go ahead.
May I add one other thing, please?
Sure.
I find that the National Geographic television show leaves a lot to be desired. It's rather flaccid and weak and tries to be everything for everybody and is a colossal failure, but I still subscribe to the great old magazine.
Mm-hmm. Thanks very much for the call, Don.
Thank you.
So the Geographic television channel broadens things out, appeals to too many people, dumbs it down. The same criticism that Bert Grosvenor got 100 years ago.
Yeah, I think the idea is to reach out to a new audience that isn't following the magazine, so it must be working.
Mm-hmm. We should point out that after Don's phone call that I think Geographic issued a swimsuit issue last year, a little bit different from perhaps Sports Illustrated, but nevertheless, the magazine came in for fresh criticism on that as well.
Yes, that produced a lot of mail. Mm-hmm. And I think most of those people in the swimsuits were fully clothed, though.
Let's talk about the magazine's association with famous explorers and famous expeditions. When did the Society go from basically being a magazine publisher to sponsoring people to go around the world to find things out and then report their findings for National Geographic?
Well, the Geographic began as a small operation. They didn't have many members, less than 1,500 members at the turn of the century. And they were in the red. They didn't have much money at that time. Gradually, they began to build up the membership by 100, by 200, 300, you know, by 1,000. It slowly built up. When they had enough money to make ends meet, they began to sponsor expeditions out into the world. And in the early part of the 20th century, the great unknown was the Arctic.
Mm-hmm.
Nobody had been to the North Pole at that point. Everyone was trying to get there. So National Geographic's first expedition was to sponsor Robert Peary in 1907. They gave him $1,000, which was important to Peary and important to National Geographic at the time, in hopes that he would make it to the North Pole.
A couple of years later, Robert Peary did make it further north in that first trip to Greenland and came back and reported his results to the National Geographic Society.
In the discovery of the North Pole is written the final chapter of the last of the great geographical stories of the Western Hemisphere, which began with the discovery of the New World by Columbus. Here is the cap and climax, the finish, the closing of the book on 400 years of history. The discovery of the North Pole on the 6th of April 1909 by the last expedition of the Peary Arctic Club means that the splendid frozen jewel of the North, for which through centuries men of every nation have struggled and suffered and died, is won at last and is to be worn forever by the stars and stripes.
Or maybe not.
Maybe not. There was debate almost instantly, almost as soon as Peary spoke those words and said that the book is closed. The book opened on a great controversy about whether Peary had gotten there first or Frederick Cook, who claimed to have reached the pole in 1908, a year before Peary. In the years since, these doubts have remained. To cut through all of the analysis of it, I think the safest thing to say is that Peary probably came close, but to the great tragedy of his life was that he was never able to prove it conclusively. He never really nailed it down.
When we come back from a short break, we'll continue talking with Bob Poole about the history of the National Geographic Society and National Geographic Magazine. We'll also talk with a current-day explorer about what adventures are left in this day and age. Of course, we'll take more of your calls and emails as well. If you'd like to join the conversation, our phone number is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. The email address, TOTN@NPR.org. I'm Neil Conan. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. We're talking about the history of the National Geographic Society with former magazine editor Bob Poole. His book is called Explorer's House, National Geographic and the World It Made. If you have questions about how the organization got started, how it developed, or some of the expeditions it's undertaken, give us a phone call, 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK, and again, email TOTN@NPR.org. Let's get a caller on the line, and this is A.G., who's calling from Vancouver, Washington.
That's right, in the wonderful United States. It is a beautiful day here. And I had a question about basically the future of the National Geographic. It was an unfortunate event of 9/11 that we lost some very promising young geographers that day. And I was hoping to hear that perhaps the Geographic Society has instituted maybe new programs or scholarships to encourage geo-literacy among our youth?
Yes, it has. In the past 10 years or so, National Geographic has been very much interested in promoting geographic literacy in the schools, especially in the public schools. And this is an initiative that came about through the last in this long family line. This is sponsored by Gilbert M. Grosvenor. He had this idea that we really should get back to having geography in the schools and almost single-handedly put it back on the map.
So to speak.
He got it in the schools. He and others at National Geographic sponsored and sponsor a National Geographic, National Geography Bee, which attracts millions of applicants every year. And there is also money for geographic scholarships.
Well, I think there's no better way to learn art and math and science than to study geography, and I certainly hope that you can continue on into the next century.
Hey, G, thanks very much for the phone call. We've been talking about things, well, 125 years ago or so when the National Geographic Society was founded. There were lots of places around the world yet to be discovered. What about today? What does a modern-day explorer do? Well, joining us now as he gets ready to head off to the South Pacific is Wade Davis, explorer in residence at the National Geographic Society. He's an anthropologist and ethnobotanist whose work has taken him to Haiti, Tibet, Borneo, and to the Amazon, among many other places. It's good of you to speak with us today.
Hi, how are you?
Very well. What does a modern-day explorer do? What is left to explore the world today?
Well, virtually everything's left to explore. You know, we have this idea that exploration is strictly geographical exploration, and even if you accept that limited definition, as our colleagues at the Geographic, Bob Ballard and Sylvia Earle, the great oceanographers, would tell you, most of the surface of the planet alone has never been visited by human beings, and of course that's the bed of the oceans, and of course the space remains an infinite horizon. But I think it's important to recognize that exploration has never always been about place. It's also been about knowledge and science and discoveries of new ways of being. I mean, all the great explorers that I grew up revering were people like Darwin, Spruce, Wallace, Bates, Banks, who sailed with Captain Cook. These were the great naturalists who went out to catalog creation and to try to understand the essence of the biological relationships, for example, between various organisms on Earth. And if you look at a place like the Amazon, where I spend a great deal of time, even to this day, after scores of scientists in the last 30 years have covered the deepest reaches of the Amazon, the vast percentage of the flora and the fauna remain to be cataloged. We don't even have names for many of the species in a place like the Amazon. So there is huge amounts of knowledge and huge areas of land still waiting to be explored.
Robert Poole, let me bring you back into the conversation briefly. I know early on there was a very wide definition of what geographic or geography meant in terms of the National Geographic Society. In fact, there was a vice president for the geography of the air.
Yes. Yes, and I think that's one thing that's one reason we're still sitting here talking about National Geographic today. From the beginning, they didn't have a very narrow definition of geography. Geography basically meant, according to Alexander Graham Bell, quote, the world and all that is in it. And that's what Wade Davis is talking about. That's the sort of curiosity and the broad interest that's made the Geographic go all these years.
Well, Wade Davis, let me ask you, how important is the sponsorship of organizations like the National Geographic Society? How important is the outlet of National Geographic?
Well, I think the Geographic plays an invaluable role in the sense that many of the issues that we're dealing with, issues of the erosion, for example, of biodiversity, or as an anthropologist, my concern for the collapse of linguistic diversity and the fact that we're living through an era, for example, wherein virtually half the languages of the world are being lost in a single generation, where we're losing, by definition, half of humanity's cultural and intellectual legacy. How does one begin to change that process? Well, you know, polemics are never persuasive, and politicians rarely lead us anywhere, but storytellers can change the world. And one of the things that Geographic does, unlike some of its rivals, is it Geographic not only reports on science, it creates science. And so the Geographic both allows us the means to go out on these expeditions, but it also gives us this extraordinary platform where you can take a story, however complex and however broad in its reach, and bring that story to no fewer than 250 million people around the planet in any one moment. And this is an extraordinary opportunity because, in the end, the only way we can really change the way that people are treating cultures, treating species, treating the habitat, treating the Earth itself, is to change ultimately the way that we view and value these precious resources.
I know you're off to the Marquesas, the islands in the South Pacific, in a couple of 3 weeks. What story are you going to tell us there?
Well, what we're trying to do, one of the things we're trying to do at the Geographic in terms of culture is to try to encourage people to sort of embrace what we call the great revelation of anthropology. And that's the idea that the world into which you're born doesn't exist in some absolute sense, but it's just one model of reality. And these other cultures of the world aren't failed attempts at being you or failed attempts at modernity, but they're, by definition, unique expressions of the human imagination. And collectively, they represent the sort of the human repertoire for dealing with the challenges that will confront us all in the ensuing millennia. And so one of the wonderful things that science has brought us is the revelation that what philosophers have always dreamed to be true, we now know to be biologically true, which is that we're all cut from the same genetic cloth. All human populations share the same raw mental capacity. And whether that genius is placed into putting men on the moon or unraveling the complex threads of memory inherent in a myth is just a question of cultural choice and orientation. And so what we're doing is launching these journeys to places where we can celebrate the dazzling achievements of the human mind. And in Polynesia, what we're looking at is navigation. If you took all of the genius that allowed us to launch the Apollo program to the moon and put all of that intellectual dexterity into understanding the ocean, what you would get is Polynesia, the biggest culture sphere ever settled by human beings, brought into being by the human imagination, 10 million square miles, a quarter of the surface of the planet, an area deliberately settled by great navigators, indeed the greatest navigators of all time, who with no modern techniques as we would understand them to be, were able to settle these islands flung like jewels across that vast expanse of ocean. I have sailed with navigators who in the darkness of the hull of their craft can distinguish as many as 32 different sea swells moving through the canoe at any one point in time. And their sensitivity and their awareness and their ability to interpret those swells is how they navigate when the stars are clouded by this by mist.
Wade Davis, we all envy you. It sounds like a great trip.
Thank you.
Wade Davis, appreciate your time today. He's an explorer in residence at the National Geographic and spoke to us from his home here in Washington, D.C. He's, of course, only one of how many explorers in residence are there now?
I think there's six or so.
Let's get some more listeners in on the conversation. This is, hit the wrong button. This is Paul. Paul's calling from Madison, Wisconsin.
Yes, hi. I've got two comments. I just want to mention first a humorous point, and that is Jack Benny used to joke about the National Geographic the same way that men used to talk about buying Playboy for the article content.
I see, yes, right.
And I saw an article in the mid-early 60s about South Vietnam that could have been written by Johnson's pro-war hawks in there. It was very propagandistic, very, very biased, I thought. And then after National Geographic, I believe, hired the head or the dean of the School of Journalism from the University of Nebraska, which I think was a top journalism school, they had an article on Grenada before it was invaded by Ronald Reagan, which portrayed that island in a really balanced, view from as if it were taken like a Mars man coming here to examine it. It told about what the place was, about the Marxism there, about the beliefs of the people, about the goals of the government. It was very straightforward. It was totally devoid of any judgment or propaganda.
Interesting point, Paul. Politics has certainly played a role in the Geographic from the very beginning.
Yeah, from the very start. And it's been a two-edged sword, this closeness of the editors and the, let's say, the government leaders in Washington. They all knew each other, especially early on. It was a small town. And
a lot of the early articles were written by diplomats and other people who'd been to these places.
Yes, yeah, and they were the people who were out traveling.
And the opinions they expressed weren't out of step with those of the administration.
Not at all, no. So in the early days, National Geographic got to a lot of places it would not have gotten to had it not been for this government cooperation. But as Paul suggests in his call, yes, there were times when this cooperation maybe got a little too close. That began to change in the late 60s, early 70s, when new people came in to National Geographic, especially an editor named Bill Garrett, who came from a journalism background, Gilbert Grosvenor, who had a more journalistic approach, the latest Grosvenor. They began to change the magazine, and they took some heat for it, but they made it more journalistic, more realistic, and I think ultimately it gave them more respect.
Paul, do you still read National Geographic?
From time to time, depending upon the article. There are certain places in the world I'm extremely interested, like Tibet and other places. I'll always pick up the magazine if it's on those. Other times, there may not be anything in that I'm interested in. I'll just pass it over.
Okay, Paul. Thanks very much for the call. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Let's talk now with Louise. Louise is calling from Chico, California.
Hello. Yes,
it is you, Louise.
Hello.
You're on the air. Go ahead.
Well, I just wanted to share my family experience with National Geographic. My father was born in Honey Grove, Texas in 1900. He died in Hawaii in 1999, and I was raised in Hawaii, so it was fun to hear about Polynesia. But my father went to a one-room country school in Honey Grove. He went to approximately the eighth grade, but his education about the world was so complete and so detailed because he read those magazines cover to cover from about 1918. And when I was going to school in the 1950s and 60s, if I ever had something I was supposed to look up or I needed to know about and ask him a question, there was not a country I could name where he didn't know what they grew there, what kind of government they had there. And he was so fascinated with the world, and it instilled that in me so that I loved geography. And my son, when he was 4 and 5 years old, and instead of wanting to play checkers, he'd say, "Get a map, Mommy, get a map." And we'd lay on the floor and look at the National Geographic magazine, the maps that come with the magazines. He'd say, "Now, how did the Vikings get to the Black Sea?" And, you know, we'd trace rivers. And now my grandchildren, who are just 2 and 4, we're already finding geographic-oriented games for them, and I faithfully subscribe to National Geographic magazine. In a time of where geoliteracy is so low, I think it's so important, especially as the world gets smaller, that we understand people from all over the world and are exposed to all these different cultures and places.
We're talking, Louise is on the line with us from Chico, California. We're talking about the story of the National Geographic Society and its magazine with Bob Poole. His new book is Explorer's House. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And Bob Poole, Louise's story, written many times over, that's the legacy of National Geographic.
I would say so. When I was starting out to do this book, even though I had worked at National Geographic for 21 years, I dreaded the thought of going back and reading 116 years of National Geographic. I thought it might be a little tedious. But I found that these stories that Louise was talking about from 1918 and 1920 and so on, they're fascinating. They wear well, which I think was the idea that Alexander Graham Bell and Burt Grosvenor had in the beginning, to cover things in a way that would be fundamental, that would be deep, that would be approachable, and that would hold up for a long while. Mm. They weren't trying to compete with the newspapers. They were trying to get somehow deeper, broader than that. And in a lot of cases, they did pretty well. And I think that the magazine, even though it has had these darker moments we spoke of earlier, it's generally been a force for good in the world.
Louise, thank you so much for the call.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. Let's talk with Sam. And Sam's calling from Chattanooga, Tennessee.
Hi, guys. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I was just curious. You spoke earlier of how you felt that, or they felt that, Bell felt that National Geographic was being dumbed down. I'm just curious how you managed to couple such amazing photography with such writing that's pretty much directed at third and fourth graders.
Well, criticisms never go away, do they?
They Robert don't, Poole? No. As a guy who used to be in charge of the writing at National Geographic, I don't know whether to take that comment as a compliment, but I think that, first of all, people still think of National Geographic as a photographic magazine for good reason, because it's 60 to 70% occupied by photography. That was Bell's idea. That's been the idea ever since Bell instituted it. The writing, I think, has the idea with the writing, starting with Bell, was to make it clear, to make it nonpartisan, to make it approachable and authoritative. I would like to believe in recent years that the writing has improved a lot in the past 20 years, because the magazine is now attracting the best of the best writers in the world. Paul Theroux, Caroline Alexander, Bill Bryson, Peter Hessler. I could go on, but you don't get writers like that writing at a third grade level.
Sam, do you read the magazine regularly?
Not lately. I have. I pick it up occasionally these days, but I agree that it is very clear and very concise, and I just feel that in some instances it slights the intelligence of the reader in the lack of depth.
Mm-hmm. Okay, Sam. Thanks very much. We appreciate the phone call.
Thank you.
We just have a minute or so left with you, Bob Poole, but I did want to ask, a couple of issues recently, the slavery issue and the obesity issue, do they point a way ahead for the National Geographic to maintain its its relevance?
I think so. I think that if you look at National Geographic over a long period of time, including the last couple of years, you will see the traditional natural history stories, adventure stories, combined with science and stories like the ones you just described on slavery, which probably would not have been in National Geographic 20 years ago, human slavery in the world today. Obesity, these are things that the Geographic is interested in covering, and I would predict will continue to cover.
Robert Poole, thank you very much, and the best of luck with your book.
Neil, thank you.
Bob Poole is a former editor of National Geographic. He joined us here in Studio 3A. His new book is Explorer's House, National Geographic and the World It Made, and we'd like to thank the archives at the National Geographic Society for providing the clip of tape we played earlier today. When we come back from a short break, why we might soon be walking past comedians on strike. This is not a joke. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News.